taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome once again to the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution and we teach the rising generation to be free. I'm glad, as always, you could join me today. I hope you'll enjoy this episode and you'll be willing to share it with others. Once this airs, you'll be able to find it in a couple of days on the website, AmericaOutloud.com. Just look for the Constitution Study. But I think this is important because you may have noticed that over the last several days, there have been hearings and discussions about a nominee for the position of Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. And it brings to mind the power that courts have assumed. Now, I want to talk about some of those things I heard in the early questioning during the hearing, but before that, I kind of want to set the stage. See, I found this article involving a case that involved certiorari before the court that really revolved around a question of freedom of religion.
How can you tell if you have freedom of religion? Is it because of the First Amendment? Does freedom of religion exist because the people say so? Does freedom of religion exist if government can decide whether you are properly following the tenets of your religion? A recent case before the Supreme Court asked that very question. Sadly, the court decided not to consider answering it. Our desire to worship as we please was not only one of the driving factors in the creation of the colonies in America, it is a foundational freedom in this country. The very first freedom listed in the very first amendment in the Bill of Rights to be ratified was your freedom of religion. Specifically, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. All of our states and the federal government recognize the importance of freedom of religion. Or do they? The laws of our states and of the United States provide religious organizations tax-exempt status. Under Title 26 of the United States Code, Section 501D, religious associations or corporations are exempt from federal taxation. In the Commonwealth of Virginia, not only are religious organizations exempt from taxation, but property owned and used by the organization are also tax exempt. Enter the case of the Trustees of New Life in Christ Church versus City of Fredericksburg, Virginia, which I'll just refer to as New Life Church versus Fredericksburg. This case began when the New Life in Christ Church in Fredericksburg, Virginia, claimed a tax exemption for a residence occupied by Josh and Anasari Storms. The city of Fredericksburg sought to deny the church's tax exemption. Years of litigation ensued. This case seems simple enough at first. The New Life in Christ Church claimed a tax exemption for the residents of their youth ministers, Josh and Anasari Storms, which the city of Fredericksburg denied, leading to this case. The case was heard in Virginia Circuit Court, which found for the city of Fredericksburg. After the Virginia Supreme Court declined to review the opinion, the church appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States for a redress. The process for having a case heard by the Supreme Court involves a petition for a writ of certiorari, Latin for to be informed of, ordering that a lower court produce records for the Superior Court's review. In their petition, New Life Church posed two questions. First, did the city violate the First Amendment by interpreting church doctrine? And second, did the city of Fredericksburg refuse to extend tax exempt status to the church's property without a compelling reason and thereby violate Virginia law? Now, if you follow the Constitution Study for any length of time, you probably recognize that this cannot be a First Amendment violation since neither Congress nor the federal government had any part in the situation. Now, while federal courts have conveniently ignored that fact for decades, I do want to look at this in the contents of the Constitution and laws of Virginia. While this may not be a violation of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, it very well may be a violation of the 14th Amendment. Reading from the petition for certiorari. Virginia law provides an exemption from property taxes for real property and personal property owned by churches or religious bodies and exclusively occupied or used for the residence of the ministers of any church or religious body. When the New Life in Christ Church claimed the property tax exemption for a residence occupied by two of its ministers, the city of Fredericksburg conducted an independent inquiry into the Presbyterian Church in America's Book of Church Order to determine whether the ministers actually are ministers under church doctrine. The city never challenged the sincerity of the church's belief that the ministers are, in fact, ministers. Instead, the city denied the exemption because it read the Book of Church Order to confer that designation only on ordained church officials with specific leadership roles. State law provides that property owned by religious bodies for the residence of ministers are exempt from property taxes. The issue that the church wanted the court to weigh in on was, does the city have the authority to determine who is or is not a minister for a church? So how has the city sought to justify denying the tax exemption? Primarily, the city argued that the church is not entitled to a tax credit because it misunderstands who qualifies as minister in its own faith tradition. The church tried to explain that the city misunderstood its traditions and practices. Who decides who qualifies as a minister of a church? Is it the church or the government? In sum, the Stormses perform essential religious functions within the church. Indeed, there is no dispute among the parties that they are doing religious work. See, this is a clear case of a government entity establishing the standards for ministers of a church. The city of Fredericksburg not only claimed the authority to interpret the Presbyterian Church of America's Book of Church Order to the New Life Church, which is a member of that denomination, but to override the church's interpretation of that book. The city filed a motion for summary judgment. In support, it relied on the Presbyterian Church of America's Book of Church Order, which governs the church, to argue that the Stormses are not ministers as understood by the church. It then proceeded to argue that the Book of Church Order utilizes the term minister in contexts that make it clear that the term refers to duly ordained persons with specific leadership duties. In response, the church argued that the city had misinterpreted the Book of Church Order. In particular, the church explained that while it is true that in order to deliver sermons to the congregation, a person doing so must be an ordained minister, there is nothing in the Book of Church Order that prohibits a particular church from hiring ministers to serve as messengers and teachers of the faith. On the contrary, Section 12 of the Book of Church Order provides each church rather broad authority to govern its own affairs, which would include the ability to hire ministers to cater to specialized groups, such as youth. Isn't the city not only establishing a religious test for church ministers, but by interpreting their governing convention, establishing oversight of the church itself? Since the question of tax-exempt status is a state matter, such a test would be a violation of Article 1, Section 16 of the Constitution of Virginia. And the General Assembly shall not prescribe any religious test whatever, or confer any particular privileges or advantages on any sect or denomination. Furthermore, by determining who qualifies as a minister, the city of Fredericksburg further violated Article 1, Section 16. But all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion, and the same shall nowise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities. But it shall be left free to every person to select their religious instructor. Even in its opposition to the church's appeal, the Virginia Supreme Court said, The city conceded that the statute providing a limited exemption from taxation of real estate says to churches or religious bodies, you tell us who your leader is and if they reside in church-owned property, and we will exempt that property from taxation. However, the circuit court could not recognize this violation, not only of the laws and constitution of Virginia, but the idea of freedom of religion. And since the Supreme Court of Virginia was unwilling to hear the case, we find ourselves at the Supreme Court of the United States. I do not know why the Supreme Court decided not to grant certiorari in this case. Yes, the First Amendment claim fails based on the plain language of the document, but that's never stopped this court before. There can be any number of reasons why four of the nine justices were unwilling to hear the case. Since only Justice Gorsuch was willing to publish his opinion, we'll never know the reasons why. In his dissent, Justice Gorsuch does give us a sense of the travesty of justice the court has delivered to the church. I would grant the petition and summarily reverse. The First Amendment does not permit bureaucrats or judges to subject religious beliefs to verification. About this, the court has spoken plainly and consistently for many years. The framers of our Constitution were acutely aware how governments in Europe had sought to control and manipulate religious practices and churches. They resolved that America would be different. In this country, we would not subject to the arrogant pretensions that secular officials may serve as competent judges of religious truth. Instead, religious persons would enjoy the right to decide for themselves, free from state interference, matters of faith and doctrine. Since the city of Fredericksburg refused to abide by the laws of Virginia and deny the New Life Church the equal protection of the laws of the Commonwealth, I believe there is sufficient evidence to claim a violation of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Sadly, just as the courts of Virginia have acted as accessories to this crime, the Supreme Court has allowed this injustice to proceed. I can only hope that Justice Gorsuch's conclusion is correct. This case may be a small one, and one can hope that the error here is so obvious it is unlikely to be repeated anytime soon. But I would correct it. Bureaucratic efforts to subject religious beliefs to verification have no place in a free country. So let us return to my opening question. How can you tell if you have freedom of religion? Neither the words in the Constitution of the United States nor those of Virginia were sufficient to protect the freedom of religion for the New Life in Christ Church. Does this mean we only have the rights our governments will allow? Is the only protection for your most precious freedoms a judicial system corrupted by politics and self-importance? Those in the city of Fredericksburg who have denied this church their rights work for the citizens of that city. The governor who executes the laws of the Commonwealth works for the people. If they are unwilling to follow the laws created by the representatives of the people, they should be removed. If the people of the Commonwealth of Virginia are unwilling to hold their elected officials accountable, they have no one to blame except themselves. If we want freedom of religion, then we, the people, must defend it. Otherwise, we resign ourselves to be subject to those we hire to protect our rights.
So there are really two questions that this case brought to mind. One, obviously, is freedom of religion. Does the government get to tell you whether or not you're following your religious tenets properly? But the other question, which is really relevant to my topic for today, is what happens when the courts don't protect your rights? See, we have a right to petition a government for a redress of grievance, and one of the most common ways you do that is by going through a court. You sue somebody, you challenge somebody in court, and you're looking for members of the court to give you a constitutionally based decision about whether or not your grievance is just or not. Now, in this case, the district court didn't do that. The circuit court didn't. And now the Supreme Court didn't seek justice. And again, we don't know why the court decided not to hear this case, why not enough justices on the court decided to hear this case. The only thing we know is Justice Gorsuch would have not only heard the case, but he would have reversed. Which brings me back to the question of Ketanji Brown Jackson, the lady who is currently nominated to the Supreme Court of the United States and is currently, or at least as of this recording, is going through confirmation hearings. I wanted to take a look at, with this context of if courts are there to protect the people's rights by applying the Constitution and the laws, what should we be looking for in a justice of any federal court? But we're dealing here specifically with a Supreme Court justice. What should we be looking for? Now, President Biden made no bones. He wanted a black woman. That was his standard. It, first and foremost, it had to be a black woman. And not surprisingly, like so much of what happens in Washington today, well, this all comes around with partisan politics. So on the committee that had the hearing, sure enough, Democratic senators were very, effusive and, oh, this is wonderful. Look at how historic this is. Look at how great this is. The Republicans, not so much. But Senator Lindsey Graham did bring up an interesting, shall we say, double standard.
Most of us couldn't go back to our offices during Kavanaugh without getting spit on. Hope that doesn't happen to y'all. I don't think it will. As to the historic nature of your appointment, I understand. But when I get lectured about this from my Democratic colleagues, I remember Janice Rogers Brown, an African-American woman. It was filibustered by the same people praising you. I remember Miguel Estrada, one of the finest people I ever met. Completely wiped out. Didn't make it through the gang of 14, whatever gang I was in. I've been in so many, I can't remember. He didn't make the cut. Well-lived life just completely ruined. So if you're Hispanic or African-American conservative, it's about your philosophy. Now it's going to be about the historic nature of the pick.
So, again, Senator Graham is a Republican. And what we see is a partisan nature, right? When there were Republican-nominated black women, this time not for Supreme Court, but for another federal court, torn apart, filibustered in this case. When it was a Hispanic man, their character was assassinated. But now that it's a Democratic black woman, well, now they're worried less and less about character. They're worried more about the historic nature. Now, okay, it's historic, but are we hiring her to be an historic justice, or are we hiring her to do a job? And that's why, yes, Lindsey Graham goes on, he was talking about the need to ask difficult questions. Yes, you need to ask difficult questions. You are vetting a potential candidate for the highest court in the land. That is certainly something that should not be done flippantly, and it should not be done based on partisan politics. Now, during her opening statements, nominee Jackson did make something I want to focus on. I want to spend a little time on.
I have been a judge for nearly a decade now, and I take that responsibility and my duty to be independent very seriously. I decide cases from a neutral posture. I evaluate the facts, and I interpret and apply the law to the facts of the case before me without fear or favor, consistent with my judicial oath.
Now, this is exactly what I would expect to hear. It's the words we all want to hear. She takes her position seriously. I would hope she would. She decides cases from a neutral posture. Again, I would hope she would. She says she decides cases without fear or, how did she put it, fear or prejudice. And I would hope she would. But if we've learned anything, not only from recent history, but from the nominations and appointments of Supreme Court justices for decades, what they say is often not what they do. So I would like to take some time, and I want to go through and see some of this and say, all right, that sounds wonderful. What have you done? I don't mean what have you done as a black woman? What have you done as a judge? Because Judge Jackson has a little bit of unique history. She has spent most of her time in the district courts, not the appellate courts. And the reason that's important, as I understand it, the district courts are courts of fact. They look at the facts of a case to come to a decision, where an appellate court is looking at the law and seeing if the law was properly applied. Now, she spent very little time as an appellant judge, so there's not a lot of history. There's not a lot of record to look at to say, how does she work as an appellant judge? But which is why, like anything else, we need to ask hard questions. We need to make sure that we are looking not simply at what she says, but at what she does. Now, one of the things that came out of the first day of the hearing has to do with sentencing. Now, again, she spent most of her time, Ms. Jackson spent most of her time in the district court, and Senator Hawley from Missouri named seven specific child pornography cases where Ms. Jackson, as a district judge, handed down sentences below what the prosecutor had requested and what federal sentencing guidelines recommended. Now, I want to make a point, because I've heard a lot of people put this up as a red flag that she's soft on crime. She, you know, look at this. She doesn't, you know, that she's soft on child pornography crimes, that she's not fit for that. And I can't say that. See, when a judge hands down a sentence, they're looking at everything, that at least I'd hope they're looking at everything that's involved. Now, a prosecutor is going to request the maximum sentence they think they can get. It makes sense, right? The prosecutor, for the most part, is going to look at the case and say, well, you know, I think I can get this, or I think this is fair. The prosecutor, in their role as prosecutor, is going to want a harsher sentence. Federal sentencing guidelines are just that. They are guidelines. They're not mandatory minimums. So we give judges discretion. Now, the question then becomes, were these the only cases where Judge Jackson provided a very low sentence? That may or may not be that big a deal. My biggest question is, why? What was the justification for her giving these sentences? Because there could be plenty of mitigating circumstances where this is taken out of context, looks bad. In context, maybe not so much. Trust me, I've seen plenty of cases where the sentencing was light and really below what really was required for the crime that had been committed. There's a podcast I listen to, and every day they list what they call their recidivist report. And in that they talk about, and this is a, by the way, it's Cam Edwards that does this. And he talks about cases where people were convicted of crimes, generally violent crimes, given a very minimal sentence, and then turn around and commit another crime, sometimes frequently even more serious than the one they were originally convicted of. So I'm not saying this doesn't happen. And I'm not saying that that Judge Jackson has not been under sentencing in these cases. What I want you to do is look at this and say, maybe there's something there. Simply because a judge looks at a case and doesn't give the prosecutor what they want is not an example of a bad judge. There are a lot of cases where what the prosecutor wants is much more harsh than it would be just in that situation. But neither does it show her to be the fact that she doesn't follow the guidelines, or that she's sentenced outside the guidelines. It's not that she doesn't follow them. That's just what they are. They're guidelines. And she used her judgment. I would have to see those cases to see were those justified. And I haven't seen that data yet. Maybe it's out there. Maybe I'll stumble across it, but I haven't seen that yet. But I want to make those two points before I have to head out to a break. Before I do, I wanted to make those two points. One about the partisanship. These are partisan hearings. This is a partisan debate. It is much more about political party than it is about the qualifications of the nominee. That's the way of the world. So what Congress has devolved to. And the biggest question I've heard so far, that of her soft sentencing on child pornography, I need the context. I need to know why. There's not enough data yet to make a conclusion. At least, I don't believe I've seen enough data to make this conclusion. Now, if there's out there and we find it, I will bring it to you. But to me, that's not a disqualification yet. So as I said, I have to head off to a break. But before I do, I would like you to head over, please, to constitutionstudy.com. That is the website where everything we do here at the Constitution Study is dealt with. You can find articles, videos. You can find out where I'm speaking. You can ask me to come speak to one of your events. You could even ask a question. Please, I'm looking for questions. I want to do another Q&A segment, but I need questions. So go to constitutionstudy.com. Click the Ask a Question button, and then just hit the check mark that says you'd like me to answer it on the radio, and I will do that. So please head over there and help support the work that we're doing, help spread the word, help being involved. Now, also, I want you to head over, please, to HealthyCell.com. Now, I don't know if you've been there. The Immune Super Boost, which I use, especially when I'm traveling, it's been out of stock for a while. Well, great news, Immune Super Boost is back in stock. And they're offering, Healthy Cells offering, the ultimate immune boosting package. If you buy the Immune Super Boost before April 7th, as a listener, they will give you a free package of the AC11 if you use the code OUTLOUD at checkout. Now, AC11, it helps your DNA repair itself and clear out damaged cells from your body. So it is part of a healthy immune system, especially from the standpoint of aging. And guess what? Even with the free AC11, you are still going to get 20% off your first order. So now is a perfect time to get your immune system up and running, get the Immune Super Boost, get the free AC11, and get 20% off your first order. Just go to HealthyCell.com and use the code OUTLOUD at checkout.
In today's world, there's no escaping the headlines filled with warnings about emerging viruses and dangerous superbugs. Genesis is the only technology that safely and effectively obliterates harmful pathogens both in the air and on surfaces. Genesis plus HOCL neutralize these threats to your environment in just seconds. Find out more about this amazing technology at genesisfogger.com/outloud for a 15% discount. With Genesis, you'll be prepared for what's next.
Now the spirit of American liberty and justice is woven into the soul of America Out Loud. Now we invite you, friends, to invest some of your time with our magnificent family of experts, their minds and voices. It's all back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health 4 times a day. That's 120 times per month. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains full effective doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day, pill-free, ultra-absorption ingestible gel. It tastes great, comes in a convenient squeeze gel pack, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study. Today, we're talking about the judiciary. Sure, we're dealing with the nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. We're dealing with some of her hearings. We actually started out looking at a case that the Supreme Court denied to hear involving religious liberty, which kind of was the framework. You know, if the courts are there to protect your rights, how important is it not simply that we pick a justice, but how we pick a justice? Now, I'm sorry, but in my mind, Justice Jackson starts out with two strikes against her. And again, not of her own fault. This truly comes from the president. See, the president chose her because she's a black woman. He made no bones about it. His decision was, it was an affirmative act of choice. It was affirmative action. There's no other way to put it. So it makes me wonder, is she the best qualified applicant? Was she the best qualified person in consideration? Or was she simply the best qualified black woman? And again, that's not her fault. This is nothing she did. This is what the president did to her by making it public that he was choosing her because she was a black woman. Now, the second, well, it simply comes down to party politics. Based on not only the party that the president is a member of, but his past history, I'm expecting him to nominate someone who has a government-centric view of the role of courts. Someone who places, who doesn't place the language of the Constitution as a supreme law of the land, but believes it can be manipulated for the proper causes. Now, the question is that who Judge Jackson is? Simply because the president chose her doesn't mean that she is not a constitutional literalist, that she's not what you might say is a textualist or an originalist. So I hate putting people into groups like that because we all come up with different definitions for those words. Generally, a textualist means someone who follows the exact text of the Constitution, while an originalist takes that text and tries to understand the original import, what it really meant to the people who wrote that language. I have no problem with either. The question is she? Now, understand, based on the current politics and the makeup of the Senate, this is Ms. Jackson's appointment to lose. Right? So she actually is disincented from providing actual information. Because anything that she says that either accurately or taken out of context could damage that position, she may lose this nomination. Remember, the Senate is split 50-50. We've already gotten rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations. So she starts out winning. Right, because 50-50 tie, Vice President Harris casts the tie-breaking vote. Voila, Ms. Jackson becomes Associate Justice Jackson. Now, there are probably a couple of Republican senators who believe that the president deserves a nomination to have their nominees approved with very little pushback. So she might have a couple of vote margin. But if she loses more than a couple of Democratic senators, she probably loses the nomination. So let's go back and look at a couple of other things. Now, when we left, I was talking about the accusations of her, Senator Hawley said, soft on crime, that she sentenced... She gave low sentences to people who were convicted of child pornography. Now, there are three specific cases that were brought to light in a response to the questionnaire she had to fill out. There was a letter sent to the committee about this, and in that letter they pointed out three cases, U.S. versus Hawkins, which they claim Jackson sentenced a man convicted of possessing child pornography to 3 months when the sentencing guidelines called for 10 years. Then in U.S. versus Stewart, they said Jackson sentenced a man to possessing thousands of images of child pornography, along with attempting to cross state lines to molest a 9-year-old girl, with 57 months when the guidelines called for 97 to 121 months. And then the last one, U.S. versus Chazen, said where Jackson sentenced a defendant to 28 months for possession of child pornography when the guidelines called for 78 to 97 months. Now, again, those statements on their face do not disqualify Judge Jackson. All right, I'm going to say that again. Those statements on their face do not qualify Judge Jackson. I want to know the justification. Why? Why in these cases did she issue the sentences? Why did she go below the guidelines? Because there very well may be a good reason, and the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So this certainly will not hold her in good stead with the Republican side of the Senate, but to me, this is not automatically a disqualification for a position of associate justice. Now, I understand the process of going through the nomination and the confirmation in the Senate is quite rigorous. And one of the parts that the nominee has to fill out is, this case, a Senate Judiciary Questionnaire, or an SJQ. And it's designed to kind of like a case brief, right? Give the nominee a chance to answer some questions beforehand, kind of set the stage. And in this, one of the documents that was included with the SJQ dealt with fairness in federal sentencing and examination. And it laid out what Judge Jackson apparently believes and has sought to impart, not only for herself, but for her students. So in this document, she wrote, "I also try to convince my students that sentencing is just plain interesting on an intellectual level, in part because it melds together myriad types of law. Criminal law, of course, but also administrative law, constitutional law, critical race theory, negotiations, and to some extent, even contracts. And if that's not enough to prove to them that sentencing is a subject worth studying, I point out that sentencing policy implicates and intersects with various other intellectual disciplines as well, including philosophy, psychology, history, statistics, economics, and politics." Now, I want to unpack that a little bit, because these are her own, her own words. She thinks that sentencing is interesting on an intellectual level. I could almost see that to a certain extent, right? Because you're trying to place a value of justice. You want to put this, you're trying to bring the scales of justice into balance. Once someone's been convicted, what is the proper punishment? I'm reminded in the Old Testament, you'll often see that when something is stolen or destroyed or damaged, the person guilty was expected to make restitution equivalent to the value of what was lost, stolen, or destroyed plus 20%. So, for example, if you stole someone's ox, you're expected to return the ox and then pay a 20% premium for, whatever an ox went for. If an ox went for 100 shekels, you're supposed to return the ox plus 20 extra shekels. There's a 20% premium. That was a standard you see in a lot of the Old Testament. But I could see the intellectual standpoint, but I also think, and again, I've never been a judge. I've never had to sentence somebody. I also want to think about the sentence, the balancing of the sentence. You have two parties involved. You have the now convicted, and you have the victim. And how do you balance those scales of justice? I could see this being an intellectual exercise, as long as it didn't become such an intellectual exercise that it lost its true import. And that is seeking justice. You want to seek a punishment that gets justice for the victim without being unjust to the convicted. So I wouldn't want to see it go that far. Again, not a problem here. She talks about it bringing in myriad types of law, criminal law, administrative law, constitutional law, critical race theory, negotiations, and to some extent, even contracts. So we see, well, criminal law, all right, if you're dealing with a crime, criminal law obviously has to come into the sentencing. I'm not too sure about administrative law. The constitutional law makes me nervous because when judges refer to constitutional law, they're not actually referring to the Constitution. They're generally referring to what judges have said about the Constitution. And their track record has been abysmal. In fact, I met another lawyer the other day. And of course, as soon as I found out they were a lawyer, I asked them, hey, in law school, did you study the Constitution or constitutional law? This person had got done like one module on constitutional law, never studied the Constitution. So I get nervous about things like constitutional law. Now, I'm not sure what negotiations have to do unless you're talking about the negotiations between, say, the prosecutor and the defense about a plea bargain or something like that. Contracts possibly, right? What's the proper punishment when someone is convicted of violating a contract? Okay. Critical race theory. Of course, this is the red flag that's gone up for so many people. Critical race theory. What does critical race theory have to do in sentencing? Well, let's face it. America's turning into a racist country. I know there are a lot of people who want to say that. Let me rephrase that. Let's say that the legal and political and educational professions are pushing racist theories on the rest of us. See, here's the part I don't understand about critical race theory. If a person committed a crime, why should their race matter in sentencing? See, I'm sure Judge Jackson, I don't know why I keep stumbling over that, I'm sure Judge Jackson wouldn't want a black man sentenced more aggressively because of the color of their skin. Has that happened in the past? Yes. But I'm sure she wouldn't want that to happen now. My question is, would she want a white person sentenced more harshly simply because of the color of their skin? Would she want a black person sentenced more lightly because of the color of their skin? See, that violates the basic tenet of justice. And what I see is the primary purpose of sentencing, and that is to, once the person's convicted, how do you come about the most just outcome for the parties involved? And if it starts or ends or includes anything based on race, then you are not dealing with justice. You're being a racist. You are bringing race into something that really doesn't belong. And especially any of these critical theories that are brought along are designed to divide people, to destroy justice, to not get a fair outcome for anybody, but to place the thumb on the scales of justice for or against certain races, certain sexes, certain, histories. This is a red flag that I've already seen a lot of people jump on, and it certainly is a red flag for me. But she tells her students that, all right, sentencing is worth studying. She talks about intersecting with various intellectual disciplines, such as philosophy, psychology, history, statistics, economics, and politics. Again, what do these have to do with coming to a just punishment? They don't. Philosophy, psychology, history, statistics, economics, politics, I don't see how these should have a sway in sentencing. Are you telling me somebody should get a harsher or leniger sentence because of their philosophy? Because of their psychology? Maybe if it's a psychological disease you're dealing with, that might have something. History? Why should someone be punished more or less harshly because of history, or statistics, or economics, or politics? You see, while a lot of people jumped on the critical race theory, and to me, yes, that is a red flag, look at what she's talking about. She's talking about about including in your discussion, in your understanding, as a judge is coming up with a sentence, worried about the history. I don't think she means the individual's history, such as, is this a repeat offender or not? But American history. When she's talking about statistics, should someone not be sent to jail because, well, too many people of the same skin color have already been sent to jail? Or because they grew up in a low-income neighborhood? Or because they were of the right political persuasion? This disturbs me. See, remember, she doesn't have a strong appellate background, but as we look at the district background, her background as a district judge, this disturbs me. Because again, are we dealing with justice, just plain justice, not racial justice, not social justice, not economic justice, just plain justice? Are we seeking just plain justice, or are we placing our thumbs on the scales because of some perceived injustice done somewhere in the past? I don't know. This one concerns me. Another statement she had in the SJQ material said, since becoming part of the GDS, the Georgetown Day School, the GDS community 7 years ago, Patrick and I have witnessed the transformative power of rigorous progressive education that is dedicated to fostering critical thinking, independence, and social justice. If someone believes that progressive education, which very often comes down to the ends justify the means, would they not apply that to their understanding as they are reviewing cases? Would Jackson, Judge Jackson, on a court, place social justice in the mix in determining the outcome, not based on the facts of the case in front of her, but based on some social justice concept that she's brought to she's bringing to bear? See, these are the thoughts I was thinking of when I said she has a strike against her by being nominated by President Biden because of his history and his rhetoric, looking for someone who's going to change, not by legislative process, but to introduce progressivism, critical thinking, and social justice into the courts. Not based on the will of the people, but based on the opinion of a justice. But there's more. And I found this report it was actually on the New American, talking about Judge Jackson's opening remarks, talking about the time she clerked for Justice Breyer. She said, on the day of his Supreme Court nomination, Justice Breyer said, what is law supposed to do seen as a whole? It's supposed to allow all people to live together in a society where they have so many different views, so many different needs, to live together in a way that is more harmonious, that is better, so that they can work productively together. Well, that sounds interesting, but compare that to, say, someone like Bastiat. Now, if you've not read Bastiat's The Law, I do recommend it. It is not a simple and easy read, but it is worth your time. In that he wrote, the law is the organization of the natural right of lawful defense. It is the substitution of a common force for individual forces. And this common force is to do only what the individual forces have a natural and lawful right to do, to protect persons, liberties, and properties, to maintain the right of each, and to cause justice to reign over all. Two different philosophies. Now, will she follow in her mentor's footsteps of saying the law is, well, it's whatever fulfills people's needs? Or does she see the law as the common force to replace the individual need to protect yourself? The common force to do what the individual forces are naturally and lawfully allowed to do, to protect persons, protect liberty, and property. It's a very important position, because Justice Breyer has shown through his opinions that he is more than willing to allow the common force to do what the individual forces have no authority to do. that is common in many of the opinions he's written, many of the dissents he has written or joined on to. This is something we probably will not know for sure until Justice Jackson is on the bench and starts offering up opinions and votes. And that really is kind of the sad part. You see, we seem less interested in vetting the judicial temperament of the nominee than the political one. I haven't gone through all of the, I haven't listened to all of the testimony. I haven't gone through all the testimony. There's just way too much. I don't have the time for it. But what I fully expect from history and what I've so far has not been dissuaded from what I've followed up so far, is the judge, the nominee will say only what they think is necessary to not screw up the appointment. That we will not get a good understanding of Ms. Jackson's judicial philosophy. Is she truly an originalist? Or is she simply using a term, a label, to persuade others to vote for her? Does she truly see the law as doing what is right as opposed to doing what is lawful? And with all the weight we put on our courts, let's face it, America is a litigious society. I believe there are more, if I'm correct, there are more lawyers than doctors in the United States, which tells you we seem more interested in the law, in the courts, I should say, than we are in healing people, which puts tremendous weight on the Supreme Court. By the way, it puts tremendous weight on all the federal courts, which is why I'm not thrilled with the way we go about choosing our justices. I would love the opportunity to ask this justice a few questions. The first I'd like to ask her is if she would show me an example where she went against the grain, against the fold, in order to uphold her oath to support the Constitution of the United States. Not based on her opinion of what it says or what it should say or some precedent established by some other judge, but by the actual language of the Constitution. Now, maybe those sentences that she was derided for, maybe it'll come from there. I don't know. But I want to know not simply where she would say she upheld her oath of office, but where she did so in the face of opposition. I think that will tell us a lot more about this nominee than the questions I've been hearing coming from the senators on the committee. It'll tell us not only, give us a clue as to her position on originalism and the actual supremacy of the Constitution of the United States, and where she stood will give us a clue as to what are the passions of her heart. Sadly, whether this nominee is confirmed or not, I think the Senate is not doing its job properly in advising and consenting, because it seems to be advising based on politics and consenting based on party. We do not elect our federal judges because we don't want them to be politicians. They serve for the duration of their good behavior because we don't want them constantly pandering to keep their job. But the way the Senate goes about approving judicial nominees shows we do ask them to pander in order to get the job. We ask them to pander. We ask them to compromise. And if you're willing to compromise to get a job, I would be surprised if you weren't willing to compromise once you're in that job. So sadly, while I've been greatly disappointed by many of the court nominees that have won, the coin appointees that have won confirmation in my lifetime, there are a couple of exceptions. And who knows? We may even be surprised. You know, I don't hold my breath. I don't expect it to happen, but we may just be surprised. The question is, will it be a good surprise or a bad surprise? If and when Judge Jackson ends up on the Supreme Court, will it be a good surprise or a bad surprise? Or are we just going to have to wait for Christmas Day to see what that surprise is? In any case, this is an opportunity to look at the people you hire to represent your states. That's what senators are. They represent your states. Look at them. Look at how they're approaching this nomination. And ask yourself, are they fulfilling their oath to support the Constitution or not? Are they, if they are fulfilling it, could they do it better or not? And maybe, just maybe, if we took this opportunity to evaluate our employees in the Senate, to decide if they are fulfilling their oath or not, and use that to decide either this November or the two elections following whether or not they still deserve to be in office, then maybe we would end up with a better quality of senator. And maybe, just maybe, some future nominee will be judged by the content of their opinions and not the color of their skin. They'll be judged in how they approach their office and their oath to support the Constitution of the United States rather than the parts they carry between their legs. Who knows? Just maybe we might even find a time when judges will be held accountable for their behavior. When they cease to behave good, when their behavior becomes bad, they will face removal from office and disqualification under Article 3, Section 1. We can hope and we can pray, but the only way it'll come to pass is if we, the people, work to choose a better class of senator. Now, please be sure to make AmericaOutLoud.com your daily stop for all the latest news and happenings. It's more important than ever that we do our part. Share the stories, share the articles, share the podcasts and videos. Let us help secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity and to America's future.
Paid bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends.